I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Why do sneaker brands take off and crime waves die? Why do ungrammatical phrases become part of the language so that when somebody says, Winston tastes good, we say reflexively, like a cigarette should? Why do ideas catch on, like the conviction that the Boston Red Sox are going to win the World Series this year? What is the route that rumors take? Our guest, Malcolm Gladwell from The New Yorker magazine, turns these questions into something between a parlor game and a PhD thesis. The underlying argument in his book, The Tipping Point, is that the sort of social changes we're talking about don't travel along trend lines. They explode like diseases. Suddenly, everybody's got the same flu about the same time. Same way, suddenly everybody is saying, whatever, or wearing hush puppies, or reading Rebecca Wells' unheralded bestseller called Divine Secrets of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood. Super cool connection, listeners. The question is, if you knew, as Malcolm Gladwell says he does, the rules of this contagious process, how could you apply the understanding? That is, if you could give epidemic force to a good idea, what would your cause be? And who would you ask to start the word-of-mouth marketing? The connection phone is 1-800-423-8255. I mean, Pokemon goes up, tech stocks go down, but Malcolm Gladwell is also interested in social behavior. Why, for example, do suicides shoot up? Why, for all the health warnings, doesn't teen smoking come down? We're talking about tipping points with the writer Malcolm Gladwell and you at 1-800-423-TALK. Welcome, Malcolm Gladwell. We admire your stuff in The New Yorker all the time.
Thank you.
What's the tipping point? What does that mean, and how do you get there?
The tipping point is that moment in an epidemic when everything changes all at once, when the epidemic explodes. It's that week in the winter when you look around and everyone you know has got the flu and no one had the flu the week before.
And everybody's saying, I don't think so.
Yes.
And you say, how did that happen?
Yeah. No, everyone has that feeling of a moment when all of a sudden people are doing things that they weren't doing, you know, a few days or a few weeks or a few months before. And that's because the tipping point has just occurred.
How does it get there?
Well, that's what's interesting about tipping points is that, you know, the point of my book, The Tipping Point, was to take the lessons of disease epidemics and apply them to everyday life, to ideas and trends and behaviors. And if you actually look at diseases and look at epidemics, the kinds of things that create tipping points are incredibly subtle and sometimes incredibly unexpected. I have a case study in the book of a syphilis epidemic in Baltimore. And you know, Baltimore in the mid-90s goes from a city with a very, very minor syphilis problem to a city with a huge syphilis problem. And the things that tipped that disease there were things that you would never have thought that could have that kind of effect. I mean, minor changes in the way that they were treating syphilis and the number of doctors available in the clinics. Really, really sort of subtle changes can be sufficient to change, to create really dramatic change in an epidemic. And that's a very useful lesson, I think, for examining behavior.
What did it with syphilis?
With syphilis, it was a combination of a minor cutback in the number of doctors in the STD clinics. They knocked down a couple of housing projects in the inner city, and the people who live there were dispersed throughout the city. And then there was a subtle change in the city's drug market. There was a slight disruption in the kind of traditional heroin market in that city. Those three things, none of which were dramatic, were sufficient to turn Baltimore into a city which had, at one point, one of the worst syphilis problems in the world in the 1990s.
These things also go in good directions, and the New York City crime, and Boston crime for that matter, mm-hmm. Not just sort of easing back, but really falling like a stone, are really fascinating examples. A lot of people want to claim credit for those trends. Maybe it's money, maybe it's police leadership, maybe it's not. But explain that, what you think happened mm-hmm. to big city crime as an example, and I hope people will suggest others, of things that if we really understood the dynamics here, we could not control exactly, but we could ride. We could mm-hmm. plant good social trends and watch them explode.
Yeah. Well, the thing that's interesting with crime is that you know, we had this idea for the longest time that crime was something that was influenced by very major long-term trends in society and in the economy, you know, by poverty, by disadvantage, by But if that's the case, you would expect changes in crime to happen very slowly and, you know, over a long period as well. That's not what happened. In major cities, I used the example of New York in my book, the crime drops in the space of 2 years. I mean, talking about a huge 60-70% drop in the murder rate in the space of 2.5 years. That's an epidemic change, and there's clearly something else going on. I don't mean to suggest that some of these long-term things don't matter, but there's something, there's some clear kind of epidemic element involved there. And I think that what was it?
Bratton says it was Bratton. Giuliani says it was Giuliani. What do you think it was?
Well, I think, you know, Bratton was a disciple of actually a man here from Boston, George Kelling at Northeastern University, who argued, who was a big proponent of this broken windows theory, which I actually think is a very profound and important explanation. This idea that there, that little things in the environment can be tipping points. Graffiti can be tipping points, lit on the sidewalk, quality of life crimes. All of these are tipping points that trigger much
fair
more
jumpers
dramatic,
in the subway.
Yeah, are that trigger much more dramatic changes in behavior. And I think that, that the application of that idea that you should crack down the little things and it'll bring about it has a lot to do with explaining why crime drops so dramatically in New York City. But it's a, to me, it's just a wonderful illustration of this point that social change in many cases is incredibly volatile and incredibly sensitive to some, sometimes just to the slightest push in the right direction. That's a very valuable lesson, and if we can apply it to other areas, that, I think that profoundly changes the way we approach change.
Can I ask listeners, what other areas would you apply it to if you knew the rules? 1-800-423-8255 makes the tipping point connection with the writer Malcolm Gladwell. You have specific theories, Malcolm, about the kinds of people mm-hmm. that move this virus.
Yeah, yeah.
Who are they? And Paul Revere, classic historical example.
Yeah.
But why him? And what's the type?
Well, the idea basically, one of the principal facts about disease epidemics is they are driven and generated by very, very small numbers of people, much smaller number of people than we think. Mm. I think that same idea holds for word-of-mouth epidemics, that there is a small number of exceptional people who play a huge role in the transmission of epidemic ideas. I call them mavens, connectors, and salesmen.
Say it again, mavens, connectors, and salesmen.
Connectors are people who know everybody. There are a handful of people in any group, in any social group, who have extraordinary social ties, well above. I mean, if the average, I do this names test in the book, which is I have 350 names from the Manhattan, last names from the Manhattan phone book, and you go down the list, and every time you see a last name, you know, you give yourself a point. Well, the average score is like, most people score 25, 30. There is in every group someone who scores 120 or 130. That kind of person is incredibly powerful in generating word-of-mouth epidemics, because if they like something and get a hold of some idea, they can spread it five or six times, you know, further than anybody, than most, than the average
person.
Who
are those people? What defines them?
In the book, I profile a lot of them. They are these extraordinarily social people with a lot of energy who are consumed by the kind of the task of getting to know people, of meeting people, of knowing them, of keeping in touch with them. They're the people who write little notes. They're the people who keep in touch with you after they've left town. They're the people who make, you know, phone calls all day long. And these people...
I'm afraid I'm one of them.
I think you might be one of them. They, you know, this is not typical behavior. This is behavior that's actually rare. Most of us don't do that. And, you know, I'm someone who is not that way. If I like, go to a movie, an unknown movie, and like it, I can't start a word-of-mouth epidemic because I simply don't know enough people. I can't get it outside of my own immediate circle of friends. Someone who has friends all over the place, they can. And someone who's sort of, you know, relentlessly social, they can spread the news about a new restaurant or a new movie or something far and wide in a very, very short time.
Those are the connectors. Who are the mavens and who are the salesmen?
The mavens are people who have specialized knowledge. If you examine why you make certain decisions, why do you shop somewhere, why do you go to a certain movie, why do you go to a certain restaurant, what you find is that you are relying on the same person over and over again for recommendations. Those people I call mavens. And mavens, I always give the example of this friend of mine, Ariel, who knows all about restaurants in Lower Manhattan. If I want to know about the hot new restaurant, I call Ariel. Well, all of Ariel's friends call Ariel. And if you go to restaurants in Lower Manhattan and look around the room, you will see friends of Ariel. The restaurant market in Manhattan, which is an epidemic market, right? And restaurants come and go with like a flash, is controlled by a group of Ariels. I don't think there's very many of them. I think there's probably, you know, two dozen of them. If you knew who the Ariels were, you could, you know, that's an extraordinarily powerful piece of information if you were interested in restaurants in Manhattan. Well, that's true of lots of things. That's true of shopping and books and movies and, you know, the aerials of the world, the mavens. And if you think about it, if a maven gets together with a connector, then you can begin to see why a word-of-mouth epidemic might happen. Someone who knows everyone in combination with someone who knows everything is a really powerful connection.
And then introduce the salesman.
Well, I think there's also a role play by people who are incredibly persuasive. And again, that's a very rare and unusual trait. And
leaves me out, you see. I mean, I
you don't think
connect, but I can't sell.
You can't sell. Well, these are they're separate categories. I met with this guy in the book, a guy called Tom Gow, who is known as one of the greatest salesmen in America today, and tried to get at the root of what was, you know, why he's so persuasive. And, you know, it's a really fascinating question. And but when you meet someone like that, you begin to realize as well, why do trends happen? They happen because someone like this, who has this extraordinary natural ability to win you over, gets a hold of an idea. And when they get a hold of an idea, they can make it, you know, they can really make it go a long way.
You write about the stickiness factor. Mm-hmm. What is it?
Stickiness is, for an idea to take off, it must be more than contagious. It must also, the best way to think of this is to think about the cold. We never talk about epidemics of the cold, do we? But the cold virus is incredibly contagious. We talk about epidemics of the flu, and the difference between the flu and the cold is that the flu is something that's sticky. It makes us sick for 2 weeks. It changes, you know, we have to stay at home. It changes our life. It's very memorable. Ideas have to have that same additional element of stickiness to be epidemic. And I look at that, and the chapter in The Tipping Point where I look at that is all about Sesame Street. And I argue that the reason Sesame Street managed to create a learning epidemic is that the creators of that show understood this notion of stickiness and engineered it into all of the episodes. And if you look at the kinds of things that take off, they have some additional element. I mean, the difference between a trend and a fad, for example, is that a trend is something that there is something inherently sticky about the idea or the product that is taking off.
Give an example or two before we go to the phones of things that tipped and things that
didn't.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, an example from the recent campaign, John McCain didn't tip, did he? He looked like he was going to. He looked like he was getting very close to becoming this kind of national phenomenon, and it fizzled. That's an example. That's, to me, is a really interesting little case study of something that came close, but there was something was missing in the very end of his campaign. Another example is something.
And what was it? Was it was it stickiness?
I wonder. It's a very interesting. I'd be delighted.
He moved brilliantly among sort of kinds of connectors.
Yeah, he tipped in the media. He didn't tip in the general population. I mean, that was the sort of, he won over the kinds of people who write about politics without winning over the people who vote.
He tipped among the people, the people, but not within the party.
Yeah, or maybe that was a better. Yeah, there was clearly some. I mean, politics is not something that I know a great deal about. I would be very fascinated to hear what people's opinions are about that. Another example of something that doesn't tip is the struggle against to get people to stop drinking and driving. Teens, I mean, that whole mothers against drunk driving movement tipped. And we have seen a dramatic decrease in recent years in drunk driving among teens. But, you know, the battle against teen smoking hasn't tipped. Why has one of those taken off and the other one hasn't? I mean, I think that's a very important question. If we knew what was so central to making drunk driving tip, you know, we might have a very valuable lesson that could be applied to the smoking problem, because we're talking about similar things here. We're talking about self-destructive behavior among teens, right? How do you get the teens to curb their self-destructive behavior? In one case, it worked, in one case, it hasn't.
Connection listeners, where would you apply it? The theory of tipping points and social epidemics, if you wanted to change the world for the better. 1-800-423-8255. Malcolm Gladwell, who used to do business and science writing at the Washington Post, hit his own tipping point at the New Yorker magazine. This idea is one he's been writing about in a variety of fascinating pieces. Give him a call at 1-800-423-8255. Alex is on a car phone.
Yes.
Welcome, Alex.
I have a question for Malcolm. I'm curious to hear his comments about different internet phenomena that have grown virally. Mm-hmm. Things like Hotmail or All Advantage or I1. And, mm-hmm. and some of the instances even where the mavens are compensated for growing the epidemic. Mm-hmm. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Well, you get the question?
Yeah, I did. It's a great question. The internet is clearly this extraordinary medium for epidemics, because what it's done is it's made the role of the connector has suddenly been magnified dramatically. You know, the kind of person who all of a sudden the kind of person who used to be able to reach by phone, 100 people, can reach now by email, thousands of people. And the pace of the velocity of change when something's going to the internet is really, really fast. The idea of taking mavens and compensating them for dispensing advice is a really, really interesting idea that has some short-term potential. What I worry, though, is the thing that makes the maven in your life so powerful is that the maven is disinterested. They do not have a role, a stake in the advice they give you. And if you talk to mavens, I have a whole section of the book where I kind of profile these people and why they're so important. The reason they are motivated very altruistically, and the reason people listen to them is they know my friend who I always ask about computers and who gives me wonderful advice on computers is not trying to sell me a computer and is not. That is the extra element that distinguishes the maven from simply, the advertisement in a magazine. If you try to take mavens and try to enlist them in a kind of a commercial enterprise, you risk undercutting their credibility. And I wonder, my question about a lot of this viral marketing on the internet is it something that will not work in the long term because people are going to grow as cynical and wary of it as they have of traditional marketing efforts? And are we undermining the very basis of the true social epidemic, which is that it's something from someone who you trust and who you think isn't, directly implicated financially in?
It's an interesting point that on the internet, you can email all your friends every day, and yet the other side of that is when I get an email and I see all the addressees, mm-hmm. I blow it away immediately. I don't want to know something that's going to everybody.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of things that have happened on the internet that I think are functions merely the fact the internet is very new. The Blair Witch Project was an example of a movie epidemic, a social epidemic that used the internet brilliantly. And what I wonder, though, is whether that's replicable, and that whether people won't start to get, like I said, wary, or that, also as the number of emails, or number of websites out there continues to grow, do we have time? Are we just going to start tuning this out the same way we've been tuning out television commercials and other things in recent years?
Connection listeners, what about it? 1-800-423-8255 is the Tipping Point connection phone. Patty is on a car phone.
Hi.
Hello,
I'm
Patty.
I'm interested in this concept of mavens and connectors, and sort of to replicate what the earlier caller was saying, I'm also intrigued at the role of the marketer in this.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like I think that they're natural connectors, but sometimes the marketers can be more productive in getting the word out, for instance, or making something available. What is it that drives the people to the resources that the connector presents?
Well, the what drives people is simply this notion that mavens in particular have credibility with the people that they're in their social circle. I mean, the interesting fact here is that the people who I think are critical in social epidemics are your friends and acquaintances. So it's that personal touch that transforms the information that they're giving from kind of random information to something that you might actually listen to and take seriously. I gave the example of my friend Ariel earlier. The reason I trust her is that, A, she's not working for any restaurant, and, B, she's a friend of mine, so she knows the kind of restaurant that I like. And that's a really, really important added element. And that's what gives her – oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, so she sort of, in her mind, can make the two puzzles fit. She may mm-hmm. recommend a restaurant to you that she wouldn't recommend to somebody else.
Exactly. There's that personalized element, and that's what distinguishes them from marketing, because marketing is notoriously imprecise, obviously.
Yeah, question, how much of this is dominated by professional marketers. And in the Blair Witch Project, people thought they were just getting a great idea from their best friends. It turned out it had all been planted. Marketers also, on the other hand, try to imitate the sense of a personal tip, super cool suggestion for you. What is the role of amateurs and professionals, aerials against sort of BBDO
in
the game?
Well, professionals, I think what's been going on in the last 15 years is that people have become incredibly resistant to the professional role in this and incredibly cynical about it. And that's why I think we are entering the age of the social epidemic, because people are turning their backs on traditional methods of communication and embracing these very organic, personalized methods of finding out about things and behavior. I really wonder whether professional marketers can. I think they would like to hijack this process and are trying very hard to hijack this process, but I'm very skeptical of their ability to do it.
How would they do it if they read your book and decided they had to?
Well, they would spend a lot more time trying to find and convince mavens and connectors of the worthwhileness of their particular product. An interesting middle ground here is the role that people who are not trying to sell a product, but people who are interested in social change. If you are trying, for example, to get, you know, people who are IV drug users to use clean needles, or people or teens to in at-risk areas to practice safe sex, those kinds of things where the person, where I'm not trying to sell you a product, I'm trying actually to help you and to convince you to change your to take a neighborhood that is not doing something and to create a kind of epidemic of change in their own interest. That's where I think a lot of these ideas have enormous potential, because it doesn't corrupt the process to be, if someone comes to you and gives you an idea that could help you, you know, change your life, you don't reject them and grow cynical about them. And there have been, one of the fascinating areas in social change research right now is, and I talk about this in the book, and it's going on in Baltimore, where people are taking these communities of, inner city communities and finding the mavens and the connectors in those communities, because these people exist everywhere, even in the most disadvantaged, and saying, I'm not going to try and reach everybody with this message of safe sex or drug treatment or whatever. I'm going to find the people who are socially influential and just try and convince them and let them take over the process. It's a really, really interesting new idea in trying to create social epidemics in some of these disadvantaged communities, using the mavens and the connectors and the salesmen who are there naturally, as opposed to sort of coming in from the outside and arbitrarily trying to change everybody at once. That's a really, really powerful idea that has incredible potential for dealing with teens and dealing with all kinds of people who areas where we'd like to start positive social epidemics.
It's going to be trickier than it sounds. I mean, how do you find the actual role models in a community you don't know?
Well, there's a wonderful example from Baltimore. They were doing a needle exchange program there. And needle exchange, you know, you go and you people bring in the dirt and doesn't get a clean needle in exchange. Well, what they found was that most people weren't bringing in their needles, but there were a handful of guys coming in who were handing in 200 needles at once and getting 200 in return. And at first they said, this is terrible. And these guys were going out and selling these needles on the street. They said, this is terrible, it's not working, blah, blah, blah. And then they realized the kind of guy who's coming in with 200 needles is the connector of the drug-using community. He's someone who knows everybody, knows where all the needles are, knows how to find everybody, performs this service of collecting them and bringing them back new ones, charges a very modest fee for it. And then they interviewed these people and found, sure enough, they were incredibly social, they were sort of savvy, they had an altruistic streak, and now they're taking those people and they are attempting to educate them about drug treatment, et cetera, and use them as disciples of social epidemics.
1-800-423-8255. Set your own target for a Tipping Point Connection, listeners. Rick is on the line.
Hello, sir.
Welcome, Rick.
Oh, thank you thank you to you and your staff for yet another show that speaks so well to my condition.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Actually, I spoke with...
Staff, what staff?
Pardon?
I stayed up all night to do this, Rick. Go ahead.
Oh, well, God bless you.
Thank you.
In point of fact, I spoke with you a couple weeks back about a guest you had, and we were talking about fractals. and complexities.
Yeah, that took off like a tipping point, right?
Yeah, well, that's really what all that is about. And Alex, brilliant academic anecdotal work here. Are you familiar with complexity theory, and have you studied that at all? There's a great introductory text by a guy named James Gleick, G-L-E-I-C-K.
Oh, Chaos. His book Chaos.
And
yeah.
all of that stuff. And in fact, as you pursue this more rigorously, you can actually start to zero in on where the tipping points are predictively rather than after the fact.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. There's a number of really interesting ways of describing this sort of phenomenon. The chaos one is a more sort of scientifically rigorous, and it's also a lot harder. I steer clear of that in the book just because I was interested in describing phenomena on a much more sort of everyday level. But you're absolutely right that there's a whole kind of science behind this which describes these kinds of nonlinear phenomenon. And chaos theory plays a big role in that.
Rick, thank you. We're talking about tipping points and a whole theory of how social trends, ideas, behaviors change. They don't go in big curves up and down. They explode like viruses, says our guest Malcolm Gladwell. We'll be back. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. From Boston University, this is I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Tipping Point Connection.
It's not so bad being trendy. Everyone who looks like me is my friend. Please don't hate me because I'm trendy. They're not going to laugh at me again.
Malcolm Gladwell is our guest. His book is called The Tipping Point, and it's about that moment when social trends take off. Why did Sesame Street become an American phenomenon 30 years ago, a kind of universal part of the culture? Why have antidepressant drugs become universal, acceptable? How did the sexual revolution sort of tip a consciousness? 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. We're also wondering, if you knew the rules of making things tip, what would the reform be that you'd want to move? 1-800-423-TALK. Ed is on the line.
Since I've called, I've gotten some interesting information. I'm not quite sure how to rephrase my question, because I was really impressed with how Malcolm had described the Baltimore situation. That's amazing. My first reaction to this whole thing was, if there's such extraordinary individuals who move this process, then there's a certain amount of indeterminacy to it. And that's my first comment. I'd just like to ask him, you know, to what extent does he think it might be indeterminate? And then when Chris just mentioned sexual revolution and stuff like that, I think those are much deeper things that you can't talk about tipping. Because it was, I'm specialist in the sexual revolution, and I can trace, you know, the conditions that made it favorable to the development of that. So I don't think your major trends that are deeply rooted are going to have anything to do with tipping, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm making a general comment that I'd like to hear something on from him.
Yeah, I would say, I actually, on the second point, am in agreement with you. It's much harder to talk about very global, large, long-term trends in this way. I'm much more interested in very sort of specific short-term things. On your first question about the role of individuals, you're right. There is, one of the things that makes this, I think, such a fascinating idea is it's not cut and dried. It's not paint by numbers. There isn't a kind of equation here. When you're dealing with the efforts of a small number of people, it does become, there's a real, as you say, indeterminate element here. You can't just sit a couple of people down and say, this is what I want you to say, and have them go out and do it and start an epidemic. You know, even in the case of the Baltimore example I was giving, you know, do they know the form in which this epidemic will take, or even whether that these guys are sufficient to tip it? No, not yet. But the point is that this is as good an idea as we've got, and it's a fascinating idea that's worth exploring, because nothing else has worked. The question is, what in the absence? I mean, I talk about this in the book when I talk about smoking. The traditional approach to the problem, which is not to think of it as an epidemic, has not worked with teen smoking. So the question is, where do we go from there? And I'm saying that maybe we ought to start exploring the epidemic dimensions of problems and applying some of these lessons and seeing how far we can go with that.
Ed, does that do it?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask one more thing about that then. Have you looked at the attempts by the various intelligence organizations for disinformation? Do they use this principle at all?
Oh, that's very interesting. I don't in the book. I do have a discussion of rumors in the book, but I have never done any kind of disinformation, which is actually a fascinating idea.
Ed, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about tipping points and how you get your hobby horse there. Mike is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, Mike. Welcome.
One tipping point I read once was that there seems to be a social breakdown when the illegitimacy rate hits around 25%.
Mm-hmm.
A society can handle, you know, 2, 3, 5, and even up to 20%. But there appears to be a big breakdown around 25% of the children don't have fathers in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you could maybe apply that to maybe schools, public schools, if there are too many fatherless child in a public school, then you do have a breakdown of the education system.
Yeah.
Have you done anything like that?
Yeah, in the book, this is actually, you raise a really interesting point. This is one of the fascinating things about looking at social problems in neighborhoods. You're absolutely right that it's not a gradual decline. This is great work by Jonathan Crane, who's a sociologist out of Chicago that I talk about in the book. And what he shows is that neighborhoods decline all at once. In other words, you can have, you know, a neighborhood in which people are getting progressively poor and there are more children born out of wedlock and there are more school absenteeism. Nothing will happen until a certain specific point. And when those problems hit that point, the neighborhood goes bad all at once. And that's a really, if you're thinking about turning neighborhoods around.
What's the point and how do you tell?
Well, it differs from neighborhood to neighborhood, obviously. I mean, the tipping point for, you know, a certain kind of neighborhood on the West Coast may be different from one, you know, in. But the point is that if you understand that that there are these tipping points, it changes the way that you plan any kind of neighborhood renewal or social change, because it means you don't have to solve the whole problem. What you have to do is get the neighborhood back up to the tipping point. So if 25% is a critical point, as our caller says, it means that if you're at 30, you don't have to get to 15 or 10 to solve the problem. You've got to get to 25. And that changes the way, or 22 or whatever, that changes the way that you plan a social intervention. And it makes it possible to think of a successful social intervention as a logistical possibility. I mean, because obviously going from 30 to 5% is a huge undertaking. Going from 30 to 24 maybe isn't. So maybe we've sort of walked away from some of these social problems prematurely. That's sort of one of the arguments of the book, that there's real hopefulness in this.
1-800-423-8255. Mike, thank you for the call. 1-800-423-TALK. Peter is on the line.
Hi there.
Hello, Peter.
Thank you, Chris. This is a very interesting topic. Thank you both. When you were talking about drunk driving and smoking,
mm-hmm.
It occurs that to me, in my mind, that you, MADD, MAD, also had students against drunk driving,
mm-hmm.
and that one of the major results is that young people die and that there's an immediacy. It's
mm-hmm.
also carried over by the mother, who's a strong influence in the family.
Yeah, yeah.
So the question then becomes, what's the effect of gender and peer relationships in this event?
Peer relationships are clearly critical here. In fact, they are the whole story. I mean, one of the fascinating things about looking, for example, at teenage smoking epidemics is that adults have nothing to we always used to think that adults had played a big role in the decision that teens make to smoke, and they don't. In fact, we have really wonderful research on this. It is entirely an internal teen-mediated process, and understanding that, I think, changes the way we intervene, because it suggests to us that, you know, simply adults telling kids that they shouldn't do a certain thing is not sufficient to create change. You can't just walk into a kind of closed, insular teen environment and say, hey, this thing that you think is really cool and fun actually isn't cool and fun. You have to create some kind of change that happens within the teen community itself. The genius of the drunk driving campaign is that somehow it managed to do that. And I wish we had a firmer hold on precisely what it was there, because it was an incredibly effective thing. But it happened from within. It was not kids listening to adults. It was because at some point that message became internalized within the culture of teenage life. And I have a long chapter discussion of smoking in my book, because I think smoking is a much more, even more difficult application of this problem.
Peter, can you explain the drunk driving cure?
Well, yeah, I think that that it cuts to the quick when someone in your family or friends of yours are dropping off because of having an accident. Mm-hmm. I think the issue of health is a lot trickier. I think that there's a generational gap.
I think you may be right. Michael McDonald wrote about that, about growing up in South Boston, the ritual of funerals. Mm-hmm. I mean, after a couple dozen funerals, I mean, a message gets through.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't get to the funerals till later with smoking.
Yeah, maybe that's... But the thing that amazes me is that, you know, this kind of drunk driving among teens went on for years and years and years and years and years and years, and the effect of all those funerals didn't create an epidemic change in behavior until a certain point. So the question was, you know, what was the, there was clearly some extra little element snuck in there. What was the extra little element that caused it to go from something that was simply depressing to being something that created a substantial cultural change in behavior? That is the, I'm looking for the little thing here, not the big thing. The big thing is clearly important, but there was some little tipping point here that pushed it into that realm where kids began to act on that kind of, you know, the numbing familiarity of funeral and all of the kind of the immediacy of death and something. What was that thing? That's the kind of, to me, is the interesting question.
Got to read Michael McDonald's All Souls again. 1-800-423-8255. Ethan is on the line.
Hi, thank you. I kind of wanted to get back to the mad versus teen smoking issue also. It seems to me that, like, when you see issues like drunk driving with teens, there is that immediate, like, life and death compelling consequence. But when with teen smoking, a lot of the majority of the advertising you see against teen smoking is actually made by tobacco companies. And it kind of inherently glamorizes it. Like, specifically, there's the one commercial where you see, like, the nice old shopkeeper saying, we have this sign which says we don't sell cigarettes to kids, although it parades in attractive young teenagers one after the other looking really disappointed that they can't get cigarettes.
Yeah, that's true.
And
that's
then
point.
You see the one where it's just a bunch of kids kind of talking about what parents can do to help them not smoke. But the one thing they don't say is that parents shouldn't smoke. Mm-hmm. And it seems a lot of it is kind of very self-serving by the tobacco companies. They're making this concession, but at the same time, they're not really doing all they could do, which is not a big surprise.
Yeah.
So that was kind of my reaction to that. Another question I had was, is it possible in our culture to really help kids with the so-called war on drugs when you see children being taught that drugs are bad, although they're really not given an honest appraisal of the different kinds of drugs? You're told about marijuana as a gateway drug, but, you know, they're told drugs are bad, except they're not told that there's a big difference between marijuana and heroin, for example, or aspirin or Advil. And it's just, I'm just curious as to your comments on that. Thank you.
To your first point first, I'm reminded of this very famous study, which I talk about in the book, where so done at Yale University, and they were trying to get kids at Yale University to get tetanus shots. And they play with all kinds of education campaigns and scare tactics and, you know, classes, teach them about the danger of tetanus. Nothing worked. And finally, they gave out these little booklets, which previously had been useless, and they included in the booklet a map showing the kids where the health center was, so they could actually go and get a shot. And that little change was sufficient to tip it, and all of a sudden, tons of kids were going to get tetanus shots. It's a classic example of how they thought that the key to social change was in some kind of, you know, fundamentally changing the opinions of kids towards tetanus. It wasn't. It was about including a map showing them where they could get a shot. The drunk driving thing is very similar to that, in that I think somehow that the key thing had to do with creating the designated driver, the idea that you could actually create a social role for somebody to be the driver, and that it was fine. And it was just, you gave, what we did is we gave, kids developed a language that allowed them to deal with this idea of the designated driver and a social acceptability for that role. I think that far more than, you know, the scariness of people dying and et cetera, which doesn't, the really, really key step there was just this very simple creation of that particular person. That's a really important lesson, because we think we get so caught up in the big question, which is, can we change their minds about this behavior? And forget that maybe the key to change here is some little change, and just in creating a person, not even worrying about everybody else, let everyone else drink themselves silly. Just create one person who's going to drive home. And that, that to me was a tipping point there.
1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Malcolm Gladwell. Wendy is on the line.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a psychologist, and I work with families and couples, and I've noticed that there's a definite tipping point in which the relationships are then able to be realigned or reconfigured.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't what the family of origin, what they're bringing in from that, or it isn't previous experiences, but there's some specific tweaking of a perspective, almost like the map.
Mm-hmm.
And a family is then able to see in just somewhat of a different way what's happening in the relationship, and they're able to change those interactions. And it's on a micro level, but once that change happens, then it's almost like an epidemic of mm-hmm. change within the family, within the system, within the couple.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, that, and so consistent with the way I think that human behavior works, but also, and so hard for us to understand. I mean, that doesn't accord with our intuition about how behavior thinks. We get so caught up in these sort of larger, but I think that's fascinating.
Like my broken windows theory of therapy.
Yes.
Where you just change one little thing.
Yeah.
And in fact, the couple or the family, they can go on and they have changed.
Give an example.
Well, rather than deal with a couple, say, for 6 months, deal with one specific type of behavior. Send them out into an experience in a restaurant and have them reverse roles. Have them do something that they've never done before. That is far more to the relationship than going into family of origin or what's happened. Mm-hmm. And I see it time and time again, and there's some tipping point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating.
Wendy, thank you.
You're welcome.
1-800-423-8255. Laura is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, Laura.
I'm really enjoying this. I'm from Concord, and Ralph Waldo Emerson comes to mind. A previous caller said that major trends don't really apply to this theory because they have a life of their own, if I understood that. But Ralph Waldo Emerson, it seems, was the supreme connector here in town, because he connected Thoreau and Margaret Fuller and Alcott, and without him, maybe this transcendental movement wouldn't have grown the way that it did.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that the power of an individual in mm-hmm. connecting with an idea sometimes is required to get something that is, you know, exists as an idea in itself.
Yeah.
You just need that individual to move it.
Let's hear it for Ralph. Waldo, as we call him.
Well, we didn't. Did I? You mentioned Paul Revere. I never followed. Paul Revere is exactly the same way. He is this. We forget that he was this extraordinary figure. He had the biggest Rolodex in colonial New England. He knew absolutely everybody. He was on every committee. And when he rides out that night, the reason it works is that he knows everybody along the way. I mean, he's he's stopping at the houses where he knows which stop houses to stop at. People know him, so they take what he has to say seriously. And the classic story is that William Dawes also left Boston that night, and he wrote out and saying the British are coming, and no one listened to him because he wasn't. We don't even remember William Dawes today because he was not
a connector.
He was not a connector.
Laura, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Sam is on a car phone.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, Sam.
I just wanted to make one comment and one question. My semi-snide comment is that it seems that you are able, at least I've discovered, to backdate the tipping point of various cultural phenomenon by when it appears in the popular media. For example, when cigars appear on the cover of Newsweek, you can kind of generally say that the tipping point for cigars was maybe 2 years ago, or when South Park appears on the cover of Newsweek, you can imagine that.
Yeah, Michael Porter said by the time the Harvard Business School class gets in on a new company idea, it's over.
Absolutely right. And my question, I'll take my answer off the air, was I wanted to know what Malcolm thought about the kind of proliferation of online intelligent agents, where people, online entities take your preference and say, oh, you like Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions? Well, then you should be buying the Isley Brothers box set, et cetera, in places like Amazon, places mm-hmm. that are making recommendations like that, where companies actually become the mavens and the marketers at the same time.
And the connectors. That's interesting. Yeah. If you like this, you'll like that. What about
yeah.
it?
Well, actually, it's funny because I have written quite extensively on what you're talking about. The collaborative filtering is one version of what you're talking about, this idea that they'll find your doppelganger. If they know five, yeah. If they know, your five favorite books, they'll find you another one that you'll like.
Yes.
I actually think that that's a very positive movement. I'm in favor of that. And I think that because it solves one of this problem, mavens solve a very, very important problem in the marketplace, which is that there's too many products and not enough time. And unfortunately, we don't have enough mavens. I have a maven for restaurants, as I said. I don't have a maven for other things. And I need a maven badly. And to the extent that the marketplace or that the internet and software can be used to create an effective maven for me, I think that's wonderful. And it makes it a lot easier for us to sort of intelligently find our way through this maze, which is the kind of the modern marketplace.
That's what the connection is for, Malcolm.
Yeah, well, clearly
help people through the maze. 1-800-423-8255. Kathleen is on the line.
This has been very interesting. I wanted to just bring up one point. Mr. Gladwell suggested that the idea of using connectors to affect social change was a new one. It's a very important idea, but it's not a new one. Saul Alinsky was using it back in the 1940s in Chicago, and then mm-hmm. in 1971, Rules for Radicals comes out and sort of laid out the idea.
Yeah.
So that was one thing I wanted to say. And I just wanted to ask one question, which is the scope of tipping. I'm thinking about the human rights movement, because I work in the human rights movement. And in a certain sense, you could say that tipped, but in another sense, if we're trying to convert the whole world, you maybe not. So I was just wondering what you could comment on that.
Yeah. On the first point, you're absolutely right. I mean, I just meant to say this idea is now being used by, people in public health who haven't been using it before, but it's clearly had roots before. Tipping, yeah, I mean, it depends on the community you're trying to tip. I mean, the idea that human rights you talked about has clearly tipped within certain specific intellectual communities, but hasn't tipped on a broader stage and somewhere in some other. It's just a question of how you define what group you're trying to create an epidemic for. And obviously it's harder, the larger the group, the harder it is. So I guess.
Our friend Manu calls from Providence to say that to be a connection maven, you have to be listening to a program that you know a friend would love and then call your friend and tell him or her to tune in. We count on connection listeners to do that. Thank you, Malcolm Gladwell. We didn't even get to the question of, say you wanted to stop horn blowing in American traffic. It mm-hmm. doesn't blow in Paris traffic. How would you do that? We'll leave that as a kind of take-home question. How would you start that trend, and how would you put it to the tipping point where you never heard an automobile horn anymore? This has been fun. Malcolm Gladwell, thank you. The book is called The Tipping Point. Malcolm Gladwell will be reading from it and signing books at the Harvard Coop tonight at 7 p.m. in Harvard Square. Thanks to the callers and the listeners, as always. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation. This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Network Plus, a telecommunications company integrating voice and data services to meet the needs of a dynamic business world. Network Plus, business communicating, np1.com, by White Star Tech.